something more interesting. Then, abruptly, he asked, "Why did you tell Dee Dee that the Holt house scares you?" "I said the house was weird, that's all." The word Dee Dee used was scared. He quickly turned to look at me, his eyes crinkling at the corners as though he were enjoying a secret laugh at my expense before he faced the road again. "You'll find out sooner or later that Dee Dee is a mouth. If you tell her anything, she spills it." "Come off it," I muttered. "There's no secret to enjoy at my expense any longer. We know about the murder." The car swerved slightly, and the driver in the car in the next lane leaned on his horn. Before Eric could answer, I said, "It was bad enough for Dee Dee's mother not to tell Dad about the murder. But what about the rest of you? Why didn't your parents tell him the truth before he bought the house?" He looked embarrassed. "What were we supposed to do, put a sign in the front yard? A murder took place in this house? Frankly, we were all glad when the house was sold." "Would you like to live in a house where a murder took place?" Eric shrugged. "It wouldn't bother me. What's the big deal? You don't believe in ghosts, do you?" "Let's talk about something else," I said. "Tell me about the high school." He did, and it filled the time until we arrived at the restaurant. Tony Harris was waiting for us just inside the door. As we entered, standing under a bright pool of light from a multicolored glass chandelier, he stepped from the shadows and smiled. He didn't even glance at Eric. His eyes, a vibrant blue, locked into mine, and I caught my breath. Tony seemed older than Eric. He was tall, about 2 inches taller than I am. He was broad-shouldered but slender, and his hair and mustache were dark brown. "Hello, Sarah," he said, in a voice as soft as dark silk. Infatuation. I had heard the word. Suddenly I knew what it meant, how exciting it could be. I moved a little closer to him, unable to look away, mesmerized by his voice and his eyes. Tony wasn't that handsome. He was really kind of average-looking. But there was something different, something exciting behind his smile, and something so demanding in his look that shivers ran up my spine. He reached out and took my hand, and I grasped his fingers willingly. "Come on, old buddy," Eric said, and slapped Tony on the shoulder. "I'm starving. You and Sarah can get acquainted while we eat." Tony, still holding my hand, turned to follow the restaurant's hostess, but the spell hadn't broken. I was drawn to Tony, hungry to look back into his eyes. The sensation startled me. I'd never felt like this about anyone before. Andy? No. I could hardly remember Andy's face. We were ushered into a booth. Eric pushed me in first, then slid in next to me. Tony sat across from me. As we ate and talked, Eric proudly told us about some of the practical jokes he'd played on unsuspecting friends, especially the mean, embarrassing practical jokes. I disliked Eric even more and wished he'd be quiet. I wasn't interested in him. I was interested in Tony. But while Eric was talking, he had Tony's attention, and that gave me a chance to study Tony without his noticing it. I liked his smile and the way he lifted back his head when he laughed. Tony had a quiet nature. He was somewhat of a loner, he told me, when Eric finally gave him a chance, and we talked about books. We both liked biographies and mysteries. I was surprised that our tastes were so much alike and felt even more drawn toward Tony. I was eager to learn all about him. As he reached across the table for the bowl of salsa, the sleeve of his long-sleeved sport shirt pulled back from his wrist, and I noticed an irregular purple mark the size of a quarter. Tony turned, caught my glance at his wrist, and tugged down the cuff of his sleeve. It surprised me. I didn't think he would be the type to be self-conscious about a birthmark. Lots of people have them. Eric suddenly gulped down what was left of his iced tea and looked at me with such a wicked smile I was startled. "What's the matter with you?" I began. But Eric quickly turned away and squeezed out of the booth. "I've got some errands to run," he said. Reluctantly, I gathered up my shoulder bag and started to follow him. But Tony reached across the booth, his fingers closing firmly on my arm. "Don't go," he said. "I'll take you home."
"Good idea. Why don't you do that?" Eric said.
His face was serious, but that strange smile had moved into his eyes. Was he planning another practical joke, at my expense? I didn't know how to protect myself against him. Eric turned and said to me,
"There's a guy I've got to see. It will work out a lot better for me if Tony gives you a ride home."
"You told Mom," I began, but Eric was already halfway to the restaurant door. Flustered, I stammered to Tony,
I'm supposed to be home early."
My breath caught in my throat, and I felt a little scared, maybe because of the feelings I had for Tony. I didn't understand them. I knew very little about him, but when he smiled at me, nothing else seemed to matter. The waitress flew past, slapping the check on the table. Tony pulled out his wallet and paid the bill. He edged out of the booth, unfolding his long legs, and reached out a hand to me.
"I'll take you home now," he said.
His black sports car, with its dark-tinted glass, had a clean, fresh, new car smell, and the dashboard gleamed. He fussed with the car, adjusting the rearview mirrors, checking the digital clock light, and fiddling with the radio until he found a station he liked. He kept the music low as he drove north on Kirby.
"Have you seen much of Houston?" he asked.
"Hardly any of it," I answered. Tony turned to me and smiled.
"We can take care of that."
I could feel myself melting into his smile, so I struggled to stay clear-headed, saying the first thing that came into my mind.
"Tell me about yourself. Where did you meet Eric?"
"We used to be in school together."
"But you're older than he is."
"Not much more than a year," he grinned. "It's the mustache that gives me that older, distinguished look."
I laughed with him. "Are you in college?"
"Not right now. I've been busy with other things. I might go east to school. I haven't made up my mind yet."
"Do you know what you want to study?"
"I've been thinking about pre-law. I might like to be a lawyer."
As we turned left onto a tree-lined street named San Felipe, Tony reached over and took my hand. I could feel the warmth spread all the way through my body. I was glad it was so dark that Tony couldn't see the flush on my cheeks.
"Enough questions from you," Tony said. "It's my turn to ask a few."
"Eric told me that you were frightened by something in your house. What was it?" I glanced at him quickly, but he looked straight ahead, waiting for my answer. I wasn't about to tell him. I remembered too well the expressions on the faces of my friends when I'd been open with them about the spirit that had shadowed me.
It wasn't really anything," I managed to tell Tony. "It was just a feeling I had when I entered the house for the first time."
"What kind of feeling?"
"I don't know how to describe it."
We stopped for a red light, and Tony turned toward me, his eyes drilling into mine.
"Try."
I shivered, and Tony immediately began adjusting the vents for the air conditioner.
"I'm sorry," he said. "You've been getting the full blast. Is that better?"
"Yes," I paused. "I don't know what you want me to tell you, or why." His smile was easy. We were back in traffic, and his attention was on the road.
"Just curious," he said. "Your reaction to the house, according to what Dee Dee told Eric, was unusual, to say the least."
"I never should have talked about it to Dee Dee. She blew it all out of proportion."
"Do you know what happened in that house?"
"Yes, the murder." I shivered again, and this time it was not because of the air conditioner.
"Why don't we talk about something else?"
A short time before, I'd been trying to get more information about the Holtz, but I didn't want it now,
not from Tony.
Don't you think the story of the murder is interesting?
Interesting? No, I don't want to think about it at all.
We knew Adam. Did Eric tell you?
Yes. Eric says that he and Adam are still friends.
And that's because Eric believed Adam's claim that he was having a reaction to his medication and didn't know what he was doing. Not everyone bought that excuse.
I glanced at him sharply. Do you believe Adam?
There's no reason why I shouldn't.
I was becoming very uncomfortable with this conversation. I don't want to talk about Adam Holt, I told Tony. He looked at me sharply, then turned away. I couldn't catch the expression on his face.
According to Eric, you had a lot of questions to ask.
I know, but...
Like wondering who in the household spoke Spanish. That's a strange question. Why did you want to know?
Does it matter?
No, it just seemed like an unusual thing for you to ask. If there's something about the house that bothers you and you want to talk about it, I won't put you off the way Eric and Dee Dee did. I'll listen.
I'll listen to anything you'd like to tell me, Sarah. Tony's voice was deep and soothing, and I began to relax. But I was determined not to tell Tony what I had heard and seen. Strange Sarah. I couldn't let Tony think that of me.
Thanks, I told him, trying to keep my voice light. But there really isn't anything to tell.
Let's talk about something else. Anything at all.
Anything at all?
Tony's eyes sparked with the kind of wicked gleam I'd seen in Eric's.
Okay. There's something else I'd like to talk about.
His fingers tightened on mine, and his thumb stroked the back of my hand.
Have you ever been in love, Sarah?
Again, he'd caught me off balance. My hand tingled, and it was hard to breathe.
No, I said, stuttering.
Not really.
A beautiful girl like you? That's hard to believe.
We came to another stoplight, and he turned to smile at me.
Have you ever wondered what it would be like?
I leaned a little closer to him, as though my body were behaving independently of my mind, as though Tony and I were magnets being drawn together. The way I was reacting frightened me. I inched back against the seat and said as firmly as I could, Tony, I just met you. I've only known you for a couple of hours.
A lot can happen in a couple of hours, Sarah.
His voice was low, the way it was when he first said my name. Again, shivers ran up and down my backbone. Please, Tony, take it easy. I was surprised to see him make a left turn into the driveway of our house. I hadn't been paying attention to the route. I didn't know we were so close to home. I pulled my hand away from his. Why don't you come in and meet my mom and dad?
I'd like that, Tony said. But we'll have to plan introductions for the next time. I'm supposed to pick up my own mom at 9:30.
He glanced at the digital clock on the dashboard.
I'm going to be late as it is.
They'll ask about you, since you brought me home instead of Eric.
Tony reached over and lightly ran one fingertip down the side of my face, resting it for just an instant on my lips. I trembled and sucked in my breath. His eyes were so demanding, so intense. He leaned back and smiled at me.
I'll meet them next time, Sarah, he said. Obviously, he was waiting for me to get out of the car. He must have been unaware of the effect he was having on me, and I was thankful. I didn't understand the peculiar sensations in my body or how to control them.
Thanks for dinner. I like the restaurant, I said, still stammering. I was reluctant to see him go and angry with myself for feeling that way.
As I walked toward the front door, Tony lowered the window on the driver's side and said, I'll call you soon. I got your telephone number from Eric. I gave a quick wave of the hand as I turned and hurried to unlock the front door. I desperately wanted him to call me, and I was afraid it must show in my eyes.
My face still tingled where his fingertip had touched it. Alone, in the entry hall, I heard the whispery noises again, and little scuttling sounds seemed to scurry throughout the house. Beside me, the stairway creaked, and I ran to join Mom and Dad. Of course they had questions about Tony. I knew they would. Mom flipped off the television set and slipped her shoes back on. "He could have come in for just a few minutes," she complained. "Tony had to pick up his mother, and he was late." "We like to know who you're going out with," Mom continued. "Eric had promised he'd take you home." I was uncomfortable with the disapproval in her voice. I wanted her to like Tony. "You'll meet Tony soon," I told her. "He said he'd call me. And you'll like him. He's, well, he's wonderful." I couldn't help blushing, and to my relief, Mom laughed. "When I was your age," she said, "I had the most awful crush on a boy in my class. I blushed every time he looked in my direction." This wasn't a crush. The feeling I had for Tony was very different. It was exciting and wonderful and scary all at the same time. I didn't want to tell Mom that. I just wanted to hug it to myself, not sharing it with anyone.
"This has been an exhausting day," Dad said. He stood and stretched. "I'm ready for bed."
Mom said, "It takes a while, doesn't it, to get used to new places and new ways?" She put an arm around his waist and rested her head against his. "Do you miss the Missouri office?" There was such wistfulness in her voice that he hugged her shoulders tightly.
"In any move, there's bound to be a few new ways to get used to, but everyone in the department's been friendly. Well, almost everyone." He smiled. "I suppose there's at least one stumbling block in every office, maybe to keep life from getting too routine."
He paused before he asked, "Did I ask too much? Is this move too hard on you, Dorothy?" "I've shed a few tears," Mom said. She straightened and smiled at Dad. "But I'm a survivor. As soon as the house is put together, I'll go job hunting. As for tomorrow, I'm going to start hanging pictures." She headed toward the kitchen, saying as she'd done for years, "I'll check to see if the doors are locked." Dad turned off the reading lamp next to his chair and walked toward the hall. He stopped and waited for me.
"Coming, Sarah?"
I realized that ever since I'd walked into the house, I'd been waiting for another contact from the woman. A question suddenly popped into my mind. "Dad," I asked, "that woman who was murdered, what was her name?"
He sighed. "I don't think we should get into that again."
"I'm not going to talk about it," I said. "I only want to know the woman's name." He frowned, trying to remember. "It was Darlene."
"Darlene what?"
"Let's see.
Garwood?
No. That's close, but it was something else. More rhythmic. Garwood. Garland. That's it. Darlene Garland." "Are you sure? That name doesn't fit someone who only spoke Spanish."
"I don't know where you got the idea that she only spoke Spanish. She would have had to speak English to hold the kind of job she had, especially in this neighborhood where most of the people speak English."
Dad looked at me with a kind of funny expression on his face, so I quickly said, "I guess I was confused. There was so much to think about."
"Yes," he said, "there was."
He put an arm around my shoulder and kissed my forehead.
"I'm proud of you, Sarah. If you'd been afraid to live in this house, I don't know what we would have done. You even managed to reassure your mother with your sensible, practical attitude, and that took some doing."
I hugged him tightly, wishing I could tell him about the vision and the woman who had asked me for help. But I couldn't. I wished we could be back in Missouri, but that was a stupid wish that wouldn't come true. Mom returned and kissed me goodnight. I left them and took the stairs one slow step at a time, trying to sort everything out. Who was the woman who had contacted me? Was she someone who really needed my help? Or had the evil in this house twisted itself into demons who pretended to be what they were not? Nervously, I turned on the light switch in my room before I turned off the light in the hall. With trembling fingers, I closed my bedroom door and leaned against it, waiting for, no, actually willing, the voice to return. Chapter 6. The spirit chose her own moments to make contact. When I realized she wouldn't come, I was free to think about Tony, who slipped from my conscious thoughts into my dreams. I woke to slotted ribbons of sunlight streaming through the mini blinds and to a whisper, "Trate de encontrarlo." I sat up in bed, swinging my feet to the floor and brushing my hair away from my face. "Trate de encontrarlo?" I said out loud. What does that mean? Had the words come from my dream? If I'd moved, I would have missed the slight hiss of a breath taken and held. Hugging my arms to keep from shivering, I whispered, "Are you there?" No one answered. Anxious to escape whoever was with me, I rummaged through my shoulder bag to find a scrap of paper and a pen and wrote down the words so I wouldn't forget them. It didn't take long to pull on shorts and a t-shirt and race downstairs to join Mom in the kitchen, where she was still rearranging pans in the lower cabinets. She looked up at me in surprise. "You're out of breath," she said. "Hungry, I guess," I answered, and kissed the top of her head. "Help yourself to some cereal," she told me. "The bowls are now in the cupboard on the far right." As I poured milk over my cereal, I asked, "Mom, have we got a Spanish-English phrase book?" She looked up, surprised. "No. Why do you want one?" Hunching over my cereal, I mumbled, "There are some things I want to look up. I need to brush up on my Spanish." "There are a number of bookstores near here," she said. "Two on Memorial, not too far. Why don't you buy one?" "I think I will." I waited until she was through rattling pans and asked, "What can I do to help you?" "Nothing for the next few hours," Mom said. "I want to get a little better organized first, then I'll have lots for you to do." It was too early for the bookstores to be open, and I wanted to get away from the house and the voice that haunted me. "I'm going to go for a quick bike ride," I told Mom. "I'll be back in about 15 or 20 minutes." The sun was already hot, and as I wheeled my bike from the garage, I felt as though I'd stepped from a hot shower into a room filled with steam. Moisture clung to my skin, and the hair at the back of my neck curled into damp ringlets. "Wait up!" Dee Dee ran barefoot across the lawn to the street. I pulled over to the curb, bracing one foot against it, and said, "You're up early." She grinned. She was wearing a faded, ripped, oversized t-shirt with a purple dinosaur on it that she'd slept in, I guessed. Her hair was still tousled, and her face was scrubbed clean, making her look like a mischievous 12-year-old. "I'm always up early. How was your date last night? Was he cute? I want to hear all about him." "The communication on this street is unbelievable," I answered. She giggled. "I was curious. I wanted to find out about this guy Eric told you about. I've never heard Eric even mention him, so I called Eric, and he just happened to tell me he fixed the two of you up with a date." "So? What was Tony like? Was he cute? What did you talk about?" I stared right into Dee Dee's eyes without smiling. "We talked about the murder," I said. Dee Dee gasped, and tears filled her eyes. "Oh, damn," she said. "You're never going to want to speak to me again, are you?" I got off my bike and laid it against the curb. "I'd like us to be friends, but right now I'm awfully mad at your mother." "I guess I don't blame you," Dee Dee said. "But her job is selling houses. What was she going to do?" "She should have been honest and told my father about the murder." "Then he wouldn't have bought the house. No one would." She glanced over her shoulder at our house and shivered. "It would have just sat there and crumbled. After the Holtz moved out, somebody threw rocks into the front windows, and one night someone kicked in the back door. Nobody on the street wanted the house empty. Look at it our way. Don't you understand?
No, I said. Dee Dee turned slowly and began to walk back to her house, so I added, but I do want to be friends. She lifted her head and smiled hopefully. It would be awful living next door to you if you hated me. I managed to smile back. I doubt if anyone could hate you.
Eric does, sometimes, she answered. Of course, Eric hates almost everybody. He can be so mean when he feels like it.
She wiggled her shoulders as though she were tossing off the problem between us.
About Tony, she said. I know he's tall, but what does he look like?
Nothing special, just okay, I answered, but I felt myself blush.
Dee Dee grinned, but before she could say a word, I went on. He's tall, just as Eric said, and he has a good tan, and his hair and mustache are dark brown.
Mustache?
Her eyebrows rose.
How old is he?
He said he was a year older than Eric. That would make him 19.
And you like him? Dee Dee said. It wasn't a question.
Yes, I guess I do. I could feel my cheeks grow even warmer.
Have you eaten breakfast? Dee Dee asked. I haven't. Come on in. I'll get Lupita to fix us something, and you can tell me all about Tony.
I didn't want to tell Dee Dee about Tony. I wanted to keep him to myself. I pointedly glanced at my watch, not really seeing it, and said, I've got to get home. I told Mom I'd take a quick ride, then get back and help with the unpacking. I'll see you later.
I could come over and help, too, if you'd like me to.
She glanced at our house again from the corner of her eye. Sooner or later, I'll have to get used to being in the house.
Just like we'll have to get used to living in it.
Dee Dee flinched. I hadn't meant to hurt her. I'm sorry, I told her. All of this wasn't your fault.
Dee Dee blinked a couple of times, managed to smile, and said, I'll be over in about an hour, okay?
Great, I answered. We'll put you to work. When I finished my bike ride, I wheeled the bike into the garage and went back inside the house, where Mom was on her hands and knees, her head inside one of the kitchen cupboards.
Are you sure I can't do that for you? I asked.
She squirmed backward until she could sit upright.
No thanks, she said. I know exactly where I want to put everything in my kitchen.
She pointed toward the end of the counter. I've made a shopping list. Why don't you take the car and run down to the store? By the time you've bought the groceries, the bookstores will be open. Then you can stop by the vet's and get Dinky.
Good. I can't wait to see Dinky.
Mom tilted her head and examined me.
Why this interest in Spanish all of a sudden?
Lots of people in Houston speak Spanish. We'd always been open and honest with each other, so I felt uncomfortable about hiding my reason from her. Mom sighed and said, I know this move has been tough on you, Sarah, but when school starts, you'll make some friends.
I have one friend here already, Dee Dee Pritchard.
Mom's eyes clouded for an instant. Before she could say anything, I quickly added, Dee Dee's nice, really. Don't blame her for what her mother did.
I know you're right, Mom said, although she didn't look very happy about it.
I'm still having trouble accepting what happened.
Everything's going to be okay, Mom.
I picked up the shopping list and hurried from the room. She'd always been good at reading my face. While I was standing in line at the bookstore, waiting to buy a Spanish-English phrase book, I looked up the section on familiar phrases. Lo necesito esta noche. I need it tonight. Aquí tiene la lista. Here is the list. Trate de encontrarlo. Try to find it. Try to find it. With trembling fingers, I fumbled through my shoulder bag, pulled out the scrap of paper on which I'd written the words from my dream, and read them. Trate de encontrarlo. The same words. Try to find it. Try to find what?
May I help you? The clerk asked.
Quickly, I paid for the book and hurried out to the car. I thumbed through the book, trying to find what I wanted to ask, but the verb to find, encontrar, was not conjugated. Here was K, meaning what. Could I combine them? Or just answer K to whoever was trying to reach me? When I picked up Dinky, I was so glad to have her in my arms again that I snuggled against her fur. She looked at me as though she blamed me for her visit at the vet's. It's not my fault, I told her, and tucked her inside the cat carrier. Moving's been hard on all of us. Why should you be an exception? Dinky just sneered and turned her back to me. Dee Dee arrived at my house just as I pulled into the driveway. I'm ready to work, she said, and tugged one of the large grocery bags from the car. Spying the cat carrier, she said, Hey, she's pretty. Dinky looked at Dee Dee with a little more friendliness than she'd shown me, but once inside the house, Dinky went exploring, ignoring both of us. I watched her carefully to see how she reacted. Weren't cats supposed to sense things people couldn't see? But not a hair raised on Dinky's calico back. Mom and Dee Dee greeted each other a little awkwardly. I'll put away the groceries, Mom said. She nodded toward the maid's room. I'd appreciate it if you girls would do a really good job of wiping down the floor in there, especially in the little closet. It's a hands-and-knees job, and my back is beginning to give out. Dee Dee and I equipped ourselves with soft old towels and the wood cleanser. I'll begin in the closet, I said. The closet was so small that I couldn't get completely into it. I attacked the baseboards, scrubbing hard. I was so intent on my work that at first I didn't notice that the air had changed. It grew warmer, and it touched my face in rhythm, as though someone were breathing. I heard the words in my head. Trate de encontrarlo. K, I demanded. K, K, K. There was no answer, but the breathing became more rapid. How can I help you if you don't tell me what you want? I asked. Stubbornly, I scrubbed even harder at the baseboard, working faster, trying to break the rhythm that surged against me. It was like an excited heartbeat, a gasping, a trembling, and it wouldn't leave me alone. Suddenly, a piece of the baseboard came away in my hands. Oh, no, I said. I think I broke something. But I realized that I hadn't broken it. The board must have been loose. It pulled away too quickly. The breathing stopped. What did you break? Dee Dee was right beside me, peering over my shoulder. I picked up the small piece of board, about 8 or 10 inches in length, to see if there were nails I might drive in a little deeper in order to fasten it in place. And I glimpsed a shallow, hollowed-out place, a rough gap in the sheetrock. Inside this hollow was a bundle of papers with a thin silver chain wound around them. Move back, Dee Dee, I'm coming out. I squirmed backward into the room. She plopped down beside me as I sat cross-legged on the floor, examining the small packet in my hands. What is it? Where did you find it? She asked. It was tucked behind a loose piece of baseboard. That's a religious medal, she said, as I unwound the chain and exposed a round, silver medal, so small that I hadn't noticed it at first. The envelope on top was unsealed. Inside was a wad of currency, both United States money and Mexican pesos. Oh, Dee Dee said. How much money is in there? I thumbed through it. About $150 in U.S. bills. I don't know how much the pesos would be worth. Is there a name somewhere in there? I dropped the first envelope and medal into my lap and opened the second. Inside was a small pocket calendar, 2 years out of date. The names of the months and days of the week were in Spanish, each day crossed off with a tiny black X up through March 2nd. From March 3rd, there were no markings on the calendar. Dee Dee gasped. March 3rd is the day the murder took place. What do you think that means? I don't know. Whoever owned these things must have left this house the day before. Or on the day of the murder. You mean that the person might have seen what happened? I shivered, thinking of how terrifying that would be. What else have you got there? Dee Dee asked. With the calendar was a small envelope addressed to Rosa Luis, at a post office address someplace in Mexico called El Chapul, and there was a canceled Mexican stamp on the envelope.
Rosa? Is that your name?
I felt a shiver of recognition. I turned the envelope over and stared at it. This is a personal letter, I said. I don't think we should read it.
Sure we should, Dee Dee demanded.
She was practically leaning into my lap.
It's been opened, hasn't it? Besides, we need to know who owns these things, don't we?
She paused and added, and if they have anything to do with the murder. From the envelope, I took out a small, rough sheet of paper. It was dated about 4 years ago and was addressed to Rosa Luis with a formal heading.
Can you read Spanish?
Dee Dee asked me.
No.
Then stop staring at the letter and give it to me. I'll read it. Almost reluctantly, I handed the sheet of paper to her, and she studied it.
Oh, dear, she said.
I reached over and shook her shoulder. Read it aloud. I want to know what it says, too.
Dee Dee complied, translating as she went along, with only a few stumbles.
This is to inform you that your uncle, Carlos Reyna, died last week of complications brought on by influenza. He worked on my farm for many years, as you may know. The other workers told me that you were his only living relation, so I am writing to inform you that he is buried in the church cemetery at Hermosillo. Señor Reyna had only a few possessions. I will hold them for you if you wish, but I am enclosing in this letter the medal he always wore. With sincere condolences, Señor Diego de la Ruiz, Rancho Playa del Rey, Sonora. Sorrow wrapped itself around me, its weight bending my shoulders.
Poor Rosa, I murmured. She was all alone.
Dee Dee's glance was curious.
How do you know that?
I was puzzled, too.
I don't really know.
I took a deep breath and tried to cover by saying, I just took it for granted that if she were her uncle's only relative, then he must have been her only relative.
Wrong, Dee Dee said. She might have been married. She might have a dozen children. Parents, brothers, sisters-in-law, who knows?
She paused.
The real question is, who is this Rosa Luis and what are her things doing in this closet?
She probably worked here, I answered.
Dee Dee fingered the bills.
Poor thing. She worked hard for this money. She wouldn't have wanted to leave it behind. Maybe we could find her and get it back to her.
We can't do that.
Why not? You sound so positive.
The presence who had contacted me was Rosa. I was sure of this. But I couldn't tell Dee Dee about it. How could I explain?
I know what we can do, Dee Dee said. We can telephone Mr. Holt. Maybe he'll know where Rosa is.
No, I insisted. But Dee Dee handed me the letter, jumped to her feet, and ran into the kitchen. I hurried after her.
Dee Dee, wait a minute. I don't think telephoning Mr. Holt is a good idea.
But Dee Dee had already bent over the Houston telephone directory and was thumbing through the pages.
I know where Mr. Holt works, she said.
Yes, here's the number. I'll dial, you talk.
We shouldn't, I began, but Dee Dee had already finished dialing.
Here, she said in a stage whisper, thrusting the receiver at me. It's ringing.
Hello?
A masculine voice was saying as I reluctantly took the receiver from Dee Dee.
Hello?
I tried to sound very businesslike, but I felt strange talking to a man whose son was a murderer.
My name is Sarah Darnell. Is this Mr. Martin Holt?
Yes, it is.
I plunged right in. Mr. Holt, we're living in your former house on Fair Oaks Lane. We've found something that belongs to a Rosa Luis, and I hope you can tell me how we can get in touch with her.
For a moment, there was silence.
Mr. Holt? I asked. Are you still there?
Yes, he said,
his voice so thick with suspicion that it dropped a notch.
What do you want? I don't understand the reason for this call.
I'm sorry, I said. Maybe I didn't explain it right. I was cleaning up, and I found a few possessions belonging to a Rosa Louise.
What possessions?
I don't know why, but something kept me from telling him everything. A small amount of money and a religious medal. Her name was with them.
Oh, he said, the tension leaving his voice. Well, somehow they must have gotten talked out of sight and she forgot about them. Obviously they didn't mean much to her.
You know her then?
Yes, he said.
Did she work for you?
A long time ago. It must have been 10 years, at least. I remember it was when we first moved into that house. We only employed her for a few months. She didn't work out.
I took a deep breath and tried to sound calm. Do you know where she went?
Nope, he said. Probably back to Mexico.
I'd like to return these things to her.
Forget it, he snapped. She was one of the many illegal. She's probably somewhere back in Mexico, and you'd never find her. Keep the money. Count it as an unexpected gift.
That's all you can tell me about her?
That's more than enough. I scarcely remember her.
He broke off, his tone almost angry.
I have a business appointment. There's really nothing more we need to discuss, is there?
No, I said. Thank you very much. As I hung up the receiver, Didi leaned across the counter, asking eagerly,
Well, what did he say? Tell me!
I tightly gripped the envelope that held Rosa Louise's few possessions. He said he barely remembered her, that she worked here for just a few months when they first moved into this house. Didi looked disappointed.
So that's that.
Let's keep this to ourselves, I told her. At least for now, I'd just as soon no one else knew about it. Didi tried to look innocent.
Sure, if you want. I can keep a secret, no matter what Eric says about me. But I don't understand why...
No real reason. Just humor me, okay? But I did have a reason. The dates Mr. Holt gave me were years before the dates on the letter and on the calendar. Martin Holt had lied to me, and I wanted to know why.
Chapter 7. When Didi left for lifeguard duty, I was glad. I needed time to think. Mom handed me a folded newspaper.
Do me a favor and take this out to the garage, she said. As I glanced at the newspaper, the front page headlines gave me an idea.
Do you think that the Houston Post or the Houston Chronicle would let me look up back copies of their newspapers? I asked Mom.
You can find back issues of local papers on film in any city's downtown library.
She straightened, a hand at the small of her back, and leaned against the kitchen counter, studying me.
You want to read about the murder, don't you?
Yes. Her forehead puckered.
I don't think that's a good idea.
Everyone else knows all the details. I think it will be easier to know what happened here than to guess at it.
I had to learn as much as possible about what really happened.
Mom hesitated.
Maybe we should ask your father for his opinion.
I walked over to face Mom, resting my hands on her shoulders. Mom, you've got to stop worrying about me. I need to be independent. I have to make my own decisions.
Mom took a deep breath, closing her eyes. She opened them, looked right into my eyes and said, All right, Sarah. I trust your judgment. If you want to go to the library, you can take the car. I won't need it until late this afternoon.
Thanks, Mom. I gave her a hug, then paused.
Do you happen to know how to get to the downtown library?
She laughed. Call them up, O independent one. Ask them for directions.
Let's try this one first, the librarian said as she snapped the first roll into place in one of the microfilm readers and showed me how to fast forward and reverse. As far as I remember, the issues that first tell about the murder are included in here. The stories about the trial are in the roll on the bottom of the stack I brought you.
She studied me.
We haven't had anyone ask for these dates in a long time.
I just nodded. As she walked away, I began to forward the tape from page to page, rapidly scanning the front pages. The fast forward made me sick to my stomach, and every now and then I had to pause, closing my eyes to give them a rest. I found the story close to the middle of the film. It was under a top-of-the-page banner headline. Delivery girl brutally murdered, teenager caught, confesses. The picture of Adam Holt was not very clear, and one arm was across his face, so a school photo from the year before was run next to it. Adam was blonde and pudgy and looking away from the camera, unsmiling, so it was hard to tell about his eyes. Basically, there was not much more information in the news stories than Dad had told us. The murder victim, Darlene Garland, apparently came to the Holt store with a pizza delivery. Adam Holt met her there with a knife. He attempted to drag her up the stairs. She bolted and tried to run, and he stabbed her. The follow-up stories covered the same information. Adam told his story to two police officers while being driven to headquarters, but refused to give a written or taped confession after his parents hired an attorney. I rewound the film, according to instructions, and put on the last roll, the one with the accounts of the trial. This one had some information that hadn't come out in the earlier stories. A woman who lived across the street from the Holts testified that she had been gardening in her backyard when she heard screams coming from what she thought was the Holt house. According to her testimony, she ran inside her own house and locked the door.
"Did you call the police?" the prosecuting attorney asked her.
"Oh, no," she answered. "At first I was afraid, but then I thought how I've never heard anything like that around here, and it had to have been, well, I thought it was kids just chasing around and acting silly. If that's all it was and I called the police, I'd look like a fool."
I stopped reading. If only she'd called the police. They could have placed Adam at the scene of the crime. I rubbed my eyes, which were beginning to ache, and went back to reading the newspaper stories. The woman told the court that she thought she had remembered glancing at her kitchen clock, and she was pretty sure that it read 1:15. The defense attorney discredited her testimony, which must not have been hard to do, because the delivery girl couldn't have arrived on the scene much before 1:30. The medical examiner testified there were two kinds of blood found in the Holt's hallway, type A and type O. Darlene Garland had type O blood, and Adam had type A. The discussion about the oral confession took up half a newspaper page. The judge allowed it, even though the defense attorney reminded him that under Texas law an oral confession was not admissible. In a later issue, I read that the jury had found Adam Holt guilty of murder in the first